All righty. We're back for another week of box office battles. Greg and Eric on YouTube Live and Twitch TV. Hopefully, we will be on Facebook Live soon. But tonight, we are going to do the third battle of the first round of the top eight movies according to AFI, the American Film Institute.
I thought it was Alien Ant Farm. These are the top eight films from Alien Ant Farm.
It could be. I have no... I mean, AFI... Yeah, could be. AFI...
Wrong acronym.
Isn't there a rock band named AFI?
Maybe that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how's it going? Good to see you. We delayed this just a little bit, so we had some things you had to take care of, and that's cool. But we are live.
My nephew's fine. His tonsils are successfully out of his body, and my niece and nephew are now back at home after spending the night with us. And it was, Greg, as you can imagine, even more chaos and mayhem around this house than it is normally with my three kids. The five of them were a lot to deal with. I'm happy to be sitting here in this seat.
Yeah, I know you have younger kids. How old were the other kids that you brought into your home?
My niece is 13-ish, so she and Zoe, my 15-year-old, hang out and do the thing, and they were really sweet to my youngest, Greer, who is five. Let her be one of the girls, and they, you know, painted nails and did fun stuff. And my nephew, the one that spent the night with us, is, I think, a year or two older than Eller, and they are both soccer obsessed. So everything in the house has the potential, when those two are together, to become a soccer ball, to be kicked around and into things and onto things. And they each have the potential to run the other into a wall or down the stairs or whatever. So it was quite a bit. Kelsey and I really tried to just play referee that night. But I appreciate you being flexible. Everything is fine. Everyone is wonderful. And if I'm being honest, I like seeing my niece and nephew. I would never tell them that. I don't know why I wouldn't tell them.
Well, because then they want to be around more. You know, you like to see them, but you don't, you know, you don't want them around every day.
I probably just let them play while I watch the Olympics. You know who's good at Olympics, Greg, is this Simone Biles.
Huh? Yeah, what a day. I watched some of that today. That was great. I work from home, so it was nice just to have it on in the background. And, man, what a freaking performance that she put on today. So, yeah, congrats.
You know, for the past couple of times I've seen her compete, I've thought maybe it's just luck.
Your kid.
But no, it seems like there's some skill involved in the things that she does. So
there is a little bit of skill there. I think that I did like the fact that their former teammate, I forget the girl's name,
bitch, Michaela, whatever.
It wasn't Schifrin because she's a skier, but it was one of them. Yeah. And she said that the new team was lazy and not motivated. And of course, now they've won gold as a team, and Biles and Suni Lee took bronze. So it was pretty good today.
Sour grapes.
I know. It's crazy.
Too much. Hey, Greg, how do you feel about sports that use subjective scoring? Do you still consider those sports? Things like diving, things like gymnastics, where judges get to decide what your score was?
I don't watch them regularly, so I guess it doesn't really matter. I guess when it comes down to like the figure skating stuff and the controversies they've had with judging. Is this going to be another Wendy's nuts in my mouth joke that I'm just going
to... No, I just... There are people who consider like gymnastics a very respected display of coordination and strength, and yes, as an athletic event is great, but they will not consider it a sport because the judging is subjective. And I just wondered if you were one of those people.
It doesn't bother me one way or the other. As long as the U.S. is the one they're being subjective to, I guess when it affects me, then I get it.
It's who when it's the object of a sentence, mm-hmm, and it's whom when you're the subject of the sentence.
Okay.
I don't know. what are we talking about tonight? We're talking about...
We're going to talk about two movies. First, I want to tell you what I did on... Was it Tuesday? Yeah, Tuesday night. I went to see Straight No Chaser and Lisa Loeb at our local concert venue here. And it was a Back to the 90s event. So I don't know if you've seen my pictures yet.
No, but you only hear what you want to, Greg.
I know. Yeah, I want you to stay and look at these.
It's so great.
Yeah, so this is, we dressed up for the Back to the 90s deal. This is my swag outfit to go back to the 90s. And that's me with Lisa Loeb.
It looks like you had the same problem with a Back to the 90s event as Kelsey and I did. In that everything you look up about the 90s is exactly what we're seeing here in this photo of you. But nobody in the 90s actually dressed this way. It's this odd, like, thing that we've created around the 90s. Like, I was just wearing, like, Yaga shirts and Massimo and this stuff's so weird. But yeah, man, and you got to meet Lisa Loeb.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
What was great was I approached her, and my wife had just run off because Straight No Chaser had started. She was like, I'm out, I'm going, because she loves them. So I get up there and I go, that was my wife, and I go, by the way, I had a really big crush on you in the 90s. And I said, but now that, you know, I met my wife not long after, and so now you have no chance. And she put her hands and just went, so I could have had all of this.
She looks up and down. Yeah. Dodged a real bullet there, Lisa.
And then she went, damn, I missed out. And I was like, yeah, that's true.
So, I wonder how many times she has heard that in her life, of probably the same number of times that Jarrett, our friend Jarrett Reddick, has heard, my mom really loves your band.
Yeah. Kids. Yeah, that's when you know your band's getting old, when somebody refers to their moms as being a part of it. But, you know, or yeah, that's pretty bad. But yeah, some cripply us just put out there, I look like I crashed into the Saved by the Bell intro, which is, yeah, that's pretty true, because that's actually who wore those clothes, was Saved by the Bell. But I didn't know anybody that wore that. I wore, just like I wear today, I wear football jerseys and football t-shirts and ball caps and jeans and whatever. But yeah, I haven't. Brian, my style Dawkins has
jerseys.
Not, yeah, Brian Dawkins jerseys. My style hasn't changed in 30 years. It hasn't changed at all. So it is what it is. I think your screen is frozen.
God bless it.
But so if you want to pop in and pop out, this is three for three. 3 for 3. He'll be right back, folks. 3 for 3 on the Eric freezing screen. So we're just gonna carry on for just a minute. But what Eric wanted to talk to you about was, here he comes back in.
I had to change my webcam to my computer webcam. You told me I needed to buy a fancy webcam. I did. The fanciest webcam that $37 can buy off of Amazon. And now look at me. Piece of shit doesn't work. This mic will go out eventually at some point during this. I won't have done anything to cause it to do that. It will just do that. Bunch of bullshit.
I hear you. You know, you sound great now. You look great now. So I think we're okay.
Yeah.
And I think that we just go, we move forward from here.
Okay. Try to have the best attitude we exactly possibly can have.
Before we get into tonight's battle, let's talk about what happened last week. If you weren't a part of the show, we actually both agreed on a film. We agreed that Casablanca actually beat Gone with the Wind. It was close. I had to look at it from a position of, if I had both movies laying side by side and somebody said, you got to watch one again right now, I would have picked Casablanca. And that's kind of how I made the decision on it. Like, both films are good in their own right, but if I'm going to sit and watch something, I'm going to watch something that's not four and a half hours.
We had to choose between the movie with a bunch of implied and overt racism versus the one where one of the lead characters takes advantage of women who are trying to escape war-torn countries for sexual favors. So it's a real tough decision. But I think we both, at the end of the day, realized that wouldn't we?
Would you rather be taken advantage of sexually than be a racist? Is that where you were going? I kind of sense that. But that's a small part of the film. And the guy is such a likable rapist.
He's your favorite character.
I actually love him right now. I think he's hilarious. But yeah,
a lot of times we identify with the characters because in our own subconscious, for whatever reason.
Oh, is that what you're trying to say?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know what I would do in a position of power, so it's probably good that I'm not in one. So I'm going to say, I'm
in no danger.
Exactly. So that after that win, that's through two battles, and this is what our bracket looks like right now on AFI's top 8 films of all time. Now, I can't announce tonight that we are going to do this battle. Then we're going to do the final one, which is going to be Raging Bull versus Singing in the Rain. And then our final four episode will be one episode together. And we're going to have a special guest star for that to help us break a tie. So that night, we can declare a winner. So just a couple more episodes before we figure out what AFI's top eight films are of all time. And that brings us to, well, first of all, that brings us to Godfather and Lawrence of Arabia, for sure. But looking at the bracket, I think we've talked about this a little bit. This is AFI's top eight films of all time. But do we really think that these are the top eight films of all time? You know, after we've gone through four of them?
Three of them are fine.
Fine. I give you that. But there's, it's like...
First of all, the whole idea is subjective. They know that the top 100 albums of all time, you know, if Abbey Road isn't the number one, you know, I can disregard the list immediately. It's things that, or John Mayer's Room for Squares album. I don't know. It's all subjective. What really is interesting, though, is that in our very first episode, number eight, we chose over number one. You didn't.
I didn't.
Me and the voting, general voting public did. So sometimes it's just about the matchup, just this movie versus this movie. And who's to say that Citizen Kane versus Lawrence of Arabia, I know who would win that. Or if it was Citizen Kane versus, I don't know what we're watching next. I'm Singing in the Rain next. You know, who knows?
Right.
But it just happened to be that particular matchup was a tough one for Citizen Kane to overcome.
Yeah, I really like Citizen Kane, but again, it is subjective. That's a personal film for me. But even I wouldn't venture to say that it's one of the top eights because there's so many. We talked about it when we did that episode, is that Schindler's List is the only film from the 90s that even somewhat current era that's on the list. So a lot of modern day audiences wouldn't look at any of these as being the top eight films of all time, you know, especially like Gone with the Wind, maybe Casablanca. But like, I have my own personal favorites. I've talked about, you know, Empire Strikes Back. I like Scorsese films. Now we've got Raging Bull coming up, but my favorite Scorsese film is Goodfellas. I also like the one over here to my right, which is Color of Money. There's great films that just, they're on this list, but they're not in the top eight. So it's kind of like when we looked at it, I kind of went, eh. And so we deep dive into tonight's films. One of them, I will say, is one of the greatest films ever made, in my opinion, if not the greatest film ever
made. And the other one is Lawrence of Arabia. Greg, I'm not going to try to derail this whole show, but I mean, I think it's fair for me to admit right at the top of the show, I'm pissed.
Yeah.
I'm pissed I had to watch this. And that bad. We'll get into it. I see that you updated the screenshot from Lawrence de Arabia.
Yeah,
and I almost clicked on that one on Amazon Prime. Glad I didn't. I do speak some Spanish, Greg. Probably not enough to understand the trials and tribulations of T.E. Lawrence in a fucking desert.
You could have clicked on Lawrence in her labia, but good thing that that you didn't, because that's out there. And
it's like, who needs 4 hours of pornography? It's a shot-by-shot remake. Yeah,
5 minutes tops.
Yeah, I need all this.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, shot-by-shot remake. Good Lord. So I didn't hate it as much as you did. I've watched it a couple times in my lifetime, but this third viewing, it wasn't an easy viewing. It's hard to say. It's slow. It doesn't move very quickly. Moves at its own pace.
I am 100% in on the life and times and story of T.E. Lawrence,
yes,
the actual human that this story is based on. Whether or not it's, as films like this often are criticized for not being entirely historically accurate or whatever the case may be.
Right.
But I read about this guy. This guy is amazing. This guy's a damn hero. And this movie did him, in my opinion, and obviously it is a minority opinion when I look at the reviews and stuff that are out there, did him no favors. I think my problem, Greg, with this is twofold, and I'm sure that we'll get into some of this.
No,
the pacing is unreal as far as taking a really interesting subject and just grinding it into something incredibly unfun to be a part of. These long shots of the desert of, I mean, I understand you're trying to create a tapestry and fill the screen like it was a painting, like an artwork, but man, come on. And second of all, for every one interesting thing that happened in this film, about 40 uninteresting things happen along the way. Nothing, so much of this didn't push the story along, didn't push character development along, didn't do anything except serve as a masturbatory, we're in the desert, so we better shoot a lot of film in this desert. It's expensive to be in this desert shooting. We better make it worthwhile by cramming this movie full of uninteresting, unplot related shots of this desert. I just, boy, did I have a tough time with this.
Yeah, you know, and you're right. To illustrate your Eric's point, for those who haven't really seen the movie, I'm going to compare and contrast a couple of clips. I have a clip from Lawrence of Arabia to show exactly what he's talking about with these shots. This is a shot when Lawrence goes back in the desert to rescue Basim, who is
Jesus Christ.
The dumbass fell off his camel, and he sacrifices his own life to go get him. But this is the scene where his servant realizes Lawrence is alive. This is an actual scene from Lawrence of Arabia. This is it. And this just scene goes on.
Here we are on Tatooine.
And that's... Oh, that's...
Come on.
What? Now, I guess in 1962, this was building suspense.
Oh. No.
But what's crazy is, like, this is not the only scene like this.
If you want to do that first-person point of view,
yeah,
approaching your intended subject, it can't just be the desert and the sky. There needs to be this. This is terrible.
So, yes.
That's bad movie making.
So, yeah. Now, to contrast it, this is what I thought when I... And this is not the first... They do it when he meets Ali, when Omar Sharif is coming out of the desert. They do it when he meets his fellow, the guy that was there, Anthony Quayle plays him, his fellow British officer that's with Prince Faisal.
About to go to Aqaba or whatever.
And he's wandering through the desert, and there's a long scene where he's just watching him, and it goes on and on. And so what it compared it to was this scene from one of the best movies ever. This is what that reminded me of.
Yeah.
It's Monty Python and the Holy Grail, yeah. The running scene. It's every time that happened in Lawrence of Arabia, I was like, it's Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
I kept thinking about, this is so good. We have to figure out a way to get Monty Python.
Seriously, yeah.
In there, because that was a big part of my brother and I growing up. But it reminded me of, often is not the right word, see these like animated, GIFs, where it'd be like a truck driving towards a wall, and then they'll cut to a different angle of the truck going towards the wall, and then a different angle and a different angle.
Yeah.
The thing is the truck never hits the wall, and it just keeps looping. And that's what this felt like was, is this a joke? Am I being tricked? And again, I want, like, the story is an epic.
Yeah.
And we just watched a movie that I would consider to be an epic, Gone with the Wind, which is big in nature, and it didn't win our matchup, but I remember saying at the time, the movie felt big, they treated it like it was big, it acted big, the sets were big, the personalities were big, and this is an epic, the story of this guy, T.E. Lawrence, of Arabia, and... I can understand the desire to want to make it big and grand. And that one scene with him on the camel, and I said, here we are in Tatooine, that's a good looking shot. It's framed well. It gives you kind of the idea of what the scope of being in a desert like that is, where everywhere you look is only sand, and it feels overwhelming. It's meant to give you that kind of anxious sense, but it's just too much.
Right.
It's just the wildest thing to find the execution so paling in comparison to the subject matter at hand.
Right.
I'd watch the story of T.E. Lawrence if it was serialized on one of our streaming services, if it were a movie I could sit through 2.5 hours of this.
Yeah.
But motherfucker. I don't know.
So, like I said, that scene that I showed you with the servant looking into the desert was a minute and 16 seconds total. And that doesn't even sum up the whole scene. There's several other scenes like that. And when you're trying to get into the story, which, like you said, is really, really good. If you know anything about T.E. Lawrence, you know, he was a British officer, was very uncomfortable being a British officer. He was serving during World War One, and gets assigned to an outpost in the Middle East. And he actually worms his way into being a liaison for Prince Faisal. There was actually three tribes that he worked with in real life, and helped lead the Arab revolt against Turkey and the German army. And the story itself is fascinating. He organized several raids on railway lines to destroy their infrastructure with like a ragtag group of fighters.
Yes.
Of freedom fighters.
It's set up the way you just described that. Who wouldn't want to watch that? It is the classic, you know, ragtag gang. It's the Mighty Ducks, but it's in a desert, and not youth hockey. Just putting
Emilio Estevez is T.E. Lawrence.
take out the just geopolitical impressiveness that we know it would take to get any three tribes of the area and of the time working together. Right. He's able to do it. A heavily outmatched, which we see in a few scenes, technologically advanced Turkish army to be able to get them to work together and to be successful. Though, I mean, it's what a neat story. Greg, I kind of came into this expecting that you would tell me why I'm wrong. Why, as a admittedly very mid movie watcher myself, you having a more scholarly view often than I do. This movie now being, 60 years old, maybe I don't get it or whatever. I fully expected to jump on tonight and you tell me all the reasons why either I didn't get it or did you ever consider this? You very rarely just tell me I'm wrong, which is nice of you. but I'm looking at the reviews on Internet Movie Database and this movie is described by various reviewers as a masterpiece, a cinematic treasure, majesty in the desert, a majestic masterpiece beyond all others.
Yeah.
Simultaneously personal and panoramic. I mean, it is, I don't know that I've ever seen as effusive reviews for anything that we've done so far. Even Citizen Kane, the reviews were more like, I guess I can see why people wouldn't enjoy it today, but what they don't realize is, and then all the things that you told me about the film.
Right.
Or there must be something you and I aren't getting about this, because this is a top 10 film, American Film Institute, and it's not number 10, and I don't know what it is.
So there is redeeming qualities about the film. And I think that Kriplius hits it on the head. He put the comment the director was given too much film. I think that this film did not need to be 3 hours and 36 minutes. It could have easily been a 2 hour and 20 minute film, 2 hour, 30 minute film with the right editing and the pacing, I think that really is what does the disservice. Because let's get the positives out of the way. Peter O'Toole, in his first like major film role, was outstanding as Lawrence. He's got the right tone of awkwardness, the nerdiness, uncomfortable with the military. He does a really great job in it. The casting is great. Omar Sharif is good as Ali, who plays, it was actually like his first major screen role. It turned Omar Sharif into a star, and he's a fantastic actor. There's others that are in it. We see Claude Rains again, Renault from Casablanca, who played Dryden. One of my favorites is when you see
Obi-Wan.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, there he is. Prince Faisal. I tell you what, I you know, the fact that, you know, back in 1962, they had a lot of white actors that played Arab parts. Commending them for having Omar Sharif in there. But all I kept seeing was Obi-Wan in this role because he talks like Obi-Wan. Any minute I was waiting for the lightsaber to come out and to start slicing Turks. I was really waiting for it. But yeah.
This is while he was hiding out on Tatooine, not wanting to be found.
I was waiting for R2-D2 to wander into the shot.
Ben Kenobi, don't know him.
I am Ben Faisal Kenobi.
Yeah, I know. It's such a... Kelsey and I talk about this sometimes, kind of as a small tangent, but that when people will get in an uproar about the casting of a part, you know, maybe there's something very specific about the character, and they, well, why didn't they hire a actual blind and deaf orphaned to play the part of the blind and deaf orphaned in the movie? And it's like, well, how far do we have to go with? Because I do understand, like, we need to create spaces in the industry and in the film and opportunities for actors and actresses that aren't white heterosexuals to play parts in films. But it's I mean, I know it was a different time too. It was 1962, but it's like, how far do we have to extrapolate this over, you know, all of the attributes of the character don't have to match up with an actor. Right. That's why they're actors.
That's
because this guy's not actually an Arabian prince.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. It's always an odd argument to have because you don't want to be insensitive, and I don't want to be insensitive. I'm a very sensitive person. I want those spaces to be available for actors of all shapes and sizes and colors and creeds and all of that. It will make all of our movie experiences better when those opportunities are given.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you know, hey, it's a white guy dressed up in
brown face.
I don't know what those
he plays the role. He plays the role well, and it was 1962, so I don't know if you would see that today. I definitely know you won't see that today. But it's funny. Your argument goes all the way back to like Rain Man, you know, where Dustin Hoffman played an autistic person brilliantly, and that's why it's called acting. And I think I saw a comedian that was saying that somebody was like arguing, well, why didn't they get a autistic person to do it? And the director was like, you ever try working with one of those people? I mean, could you imagine them trying to film Rain Man with a real Rain Man?
With a guy who acted like that all the time.
It'd
be like trying to film Man on the Moon with fucking Jim Carrey.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
Who apparently is the worst or was the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't.
But there's a time and a place. And so, yeah, in this one, though, it was funny because every time, you know, that Alec Guinness came on the screen, all I saw was Obi-Wan, especially with the robes and in the desert. So it did make me giggle a little bit. But again, it didn't take away from the story. The story itself, what took away from the story was, like we said, the pacing. It's just too long a film for what they wanted to do. Or they could have had more interesting aspects of his life in there. To the fact of what happened. I mean, I there's parts I like. I like that they introduced that this man did all these great things, and he gets killed right in the beginning when he's run off the road by those morons. And
watch where you're going, idiots.
Oh, good Lord.
A national hero.
Exactly, because they were on the wrong side of the road.
And they also killed off two of the only characters that anyone who watches this movie probably grow to enjoy being on screen.
Yeah.
The two.
Talking about these guys.
Yeah, here we are. Okay, Greg, listen, it has become an unoriginal thought for people of our age that growing up, we all thought that quicksand was going to be a bigger problem in our lives than it ever became. Because, Greg, for 60 years,
yeah,
every show on TV had at least one episode where a character got stuck in quicksand. What are we going to do? You know, yeah. Bonanza, oh, yeah. Little House on the Prairie.
Gilligan's Island,
yeah. The Jeffersons, you know, whatever, you know, multiple movies, multiple in right. media, quicksand was a big
yes.
ordeal. The list goes on and on. I bet if you Googled, you know,
oh yeah, it was a problem. It was a big problem.
It was a big problem.
Yes.
It's a problem for one of our two.
Yes.
Farage, the saddest quicksand
yeah.
scenes since
Farage Artax. and Daoud are the two servants' names. And they're really, actually, probably, like you said, some of the best parts of the film. When they're introduced, they're following Lawrence around. They just want a few bucks. They have no idea what they're getting themselves into. And when he takes them on as his servants and he overpays them, they become endearing. They become endearing characters. They're very loyal, which is really awesome as far as characters. You fall in love with them. And then, yeah, they're traveling through the desert and poor Farage gets sucked into a sand hole.
It was the dies. Secret lair of the Sarlacc Jr. under there. And then, so that.
The Sarlacc got him. Oh, my gosh.
I was pretty upset about him, but I'm like, okay, well, Greg, at least Lawrence and the other one,
yeah, at least
Raj or
Daoud,
whatever yeah. you
or Daoud. I'm going to be honest.
Oh.
One of them is Farage.
Oh. Go ahead, Greg.
I think Daoud is the one that went into the sandstorm. I think Farage was the other one because they do reference when he's all sad afterwards and they're covered in sand and he says, Daoud, yeah.
There,
but then
I don't remember thinking it at the time, but when you pulled that picture up,
oh, yeah.
like that's silly.
Oh,
I know what they're trying to do,
yeah,
but this is fucking off. Silly. This, okay.
It was, yeah.
I don't know.
And then later the other one gets it when he shoots himself in his own freaking gut the detonator. He had the detonator on his, they were going to blow up the railroad. So yeah, it's sad because the two best characters, you know, actually get killed off.
And you're implored to like them because as they're introduced,
yeah,
the whatever the guys, listen, I don't remember these guys' name. They all yeah. kind of started to look the same to
yeah.
me.
That's not racist at all.
he says, like, you don't want those two. They're orphans. They're trash. They're not worth even being your servants. And like you yeah. said, he overpays them at a shilling a week or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But
you heard it here first, yeah. folks. Eric thinks all Middle Eastern people look alike. Just saying on
that in this movie, I don't know if it was the robes or the sand or the fact that I stopped paying attention pretty early on.
Yeah.
And even after I texted you about some of the show particulars and said, you know, I'm pissed, this Lawrence of Arabia thing, and you said, you know, it does pick up, and technically you're right.
Yes,
I just don't think it picks up in a way that is redeeming to the overall experience of having watched 3.5 hours over two nights of this
yeah
thing.
So before we get into that, let's talk about one other asshole to get him out of the way, and that's this son of a bitch right here, Basim, who is like a friggin' just an anchor to everybody in this film. He is a horrible person. And he ends up, like we talked about with the scene where Lawrence has to go back in the desert to get him, does all this to save his life. And then when the two tribes are trying to come together,
he fucking
kills one of the other tribes over nothing, basically.
So then here's Lawrence. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
And he has to kill him.
And they show this parting shot of him walking away.
Oh, yeah.
And he's trying to be consoled, you know, like, you had to do it and had to. I don't think that's what he was thinking.
Oh, no.
I think he was thinking, I drove my camel miles back into the desert that they already said, as we got to it, yeah. like, we don't give even the camels any water no. from this point till we get to the other side. It is dangerous. It's scary. A lot of people don't make it. And now, and he's got to go back.
Yeah.
And then all to just end up having to shoot the guy in a honor killing for, I don't know.
Well, man. It's just to keep the peace because the guy killed one from the other tribes. And if Ali's tribe kills him, then that's a problem. Or if Anthony Quinn's tribe kills him, then that's a problem. So Lawrence is the only like impartial guy that he has, the one that has to kill Basim. And it's just like, yeah, I wasted all that time. And then there's a you know, parallel there where he tries to explain that destiny is not written because I've gone and changed it. And then one of the best lines of the movie is because he's pretty uppity about that, freaking Lawrence is. Destiny's not written. I have changed it. And then he shoots him, and Anthony Quinn goes over to Omar Sharif, and he goes, what's his problem? Well, that was the man he went into the desert to save. And then Anthony Quinn goes, oh, must have been written then. that was a good moment. I will give the movie credit on that.
And you did a great job of describing Peter O'Toole. I didn't know that this was his first mm-hmm. big role, but you're right. It was the right kind of like dogged determination mixed with he's got some comic relief.
Oh yeah.
He's quick with a one-liner, the back and forth with the one guy who comes up and shoots his initial escort after drinking out of the well.
Oh yeah.
They have a little funny back and forth, you know, dialogue there.
Takes his compass.
Yeah. Takes his compass, which I wonder how many people, like, you take 100 random people and drop them in a remote location. How many could use a compass? Like, and you just say, you know, you're 2 miles from a flag
right.
that's planted and it's due north from here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, how many people get there? I mean, I don't know that
in
I
a
could,
blinding but. Desert. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. Here's a picture of the real T.E. Lawrence on the right and then Peter O'Toole on the left from the movie. I mean,
I thought this was a still from the movie.
No, that's the real T.E. Lawrence.
In the face, they look very similar. Yeah. Apparently, their statures are very different. But yeah, in the face, they're very similar.
And like you said, an amazing historical figure who did a really good thing. You know, he did not help the Arab world get their independence, but he sparked a revolution because it kind of snowballed after the Arab revolt and after the World War I ended, and the parts of the Middle East were divided up between the winners of World War I. The Arab nations continued to fight for their independence and eventually got it. And Lawrence was kind of the spark for that. And so, yeah, the movie does a service to pay tribute to that, but I do think it suffers from really horrible pacing. The second half, like we said, it does pick up. It picks up in a very negative way. I look at the second half as a rape revenge film.
Yeah.
It is a rape revenge film because in the second half, enter this son of a bitch. So if you
I already thought we had enough conflict going on in this movie, and I really didn't want an added layer this deep into the film. Like, we're an hour and a half in.
Yeah.
Feels like we should have already established all of the players and we're working towards a resolution to this thing we've set up.
Yeah.
We're adding more.
Well, this guy comes in and he plays a significant role, but he doesn't have a major role, but it's super significant because in real life, T.E. Lawrence was doing reconnaissance in behind Turkish lines, and that's how they play it in the movie, and he was taken by guards. What I thought was done really well, because I really didn't notice the rape the first couple of times I watched this film. I noticed it this time, how the general, who is Turkish Bey is what they call him in the credits, is played by Jose Ferrer, he starts going down the line, and you notice that all the men are fair-skinned. So here they have T.E. Lawrence, who is got a $20,000 bounty on his head, but that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for a fair-skinned male,
ass.
for him. Exactly. And so when he takes his shirt off and grabs his nipple, I was like, oh. And then they show the close-up of his mouth doing the lick of the lips.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord. I could have done without. Okay. The worst part for me, I mean, obviously the rape is the worst part. but the worst part was that slow lip licking mm-hmm. close-up. Obviously between that and the rape,
yeah,
the rape is worse.
Yeah, the rape is pretty bad.
Only barely.
Yeah. And the movie does a good job because, again, it, if you're not paying attention, you just think he got beaten.
Yeah.
When I watched it this time, because the other times I've watched it, I thought they just beat his ass because he knees the guy in the nuts and then he tells him to take him downstairs and beat him. Then you notice that he's watching. Then you notice they strip him naked. Then you notice they lay him down. And then I was like, oh, okay. So
yeah, I got those cheeks clapped, huh?
It's not graphic. So I had to look it up. I'm like, all right, I want the real story behind this. It really did happen to Lawrence. He talks about after he came out of that event, he was sexually assaulted and he was changed forever. He said he was. And so in the movie, to signify that was happened, I don't know if you picked up on this, when they take him out of the prison, he's thrown into a puddle of mud to show that he's unclean. And then he was defiled.
Now,
yeah. And then you see Omar Sharif when he's watching him going, ooh, that's horrible. So yeah, it's a graphic scene. But then the rest of the film is basically Lawrence going on a freaking murder spree. He can't contain himself.
Revenge story.
Yeah. He starts making irrational decisions. So they do a good job of that. But it's like, that's the whole second half. And here's the scene when they come upon some Turks that have massacred a village and they have this choice. Do we go to Damascus or do we take these guys on? And the T. Lawrence is like,
bring it on.
And he just goes completely apeshit on these Turks.
Now this, I mean, obviously the rape was terrible, Greg.
Obviously, that was the worst part. But we can't preface that enough. The rape is the worst part. Yes.
But at the very least, what the rape did was give us some interesting moments through our act two that didn't exist in act one.
Yeah.
Where it's the build up and in act ones of movies, often, besides kind of like the defining event that sets our story in motion, act one generally is slower and it's for setup and it's mm-hmm. for all of these things. This movie has that without the kind of main conflict that kicks us all off. We just kind of ease into it. So, yes, at the very least, it sets us on a course of something fucking interesting happening in our second half of the movie. So that's the good thing about this rape is it did that.
Yes. And
but the bad part about the rape is that obviously a man was defiled against his will emotionally and physically. That's very detrimental to him. The long-term lasting effects of which cannot be understated,
but it led to wonderful entertainment for us.
But he does awesome. Go nuts.
He does. Yeah. I mean, it reminded me of Ving Rhames in Pulp Fiction. That's when you get raped. It's time to, we're just going to spend the next few hours torturing these sons of bitches.
He also was unhappy about the whole.
He was very unhappy.
Having been raped.
I'm far from fucking okay.
Okay. Yeah. Lawrence was far from okay either.
Yes. It would have been great if he would have said that. That would have been amazing. I would love for him to turn to Omar Sharif. Are you all right? I'm fucking far from okay.
In that voice too.
Yes.
Would have been cool.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
So yeah, I don't know.
I need to remake Lawrence of Arabia and add that scene. Maybe I can get Ving Rhames to play Lawrence of Arabia. That would be really good. Again, more diversity.
Did he not die? Is Ving Rhames?
No, that was Michael Clark Duncan.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Ving Rhames is still showing up in Mission
Impossible.
Now,
why would I get those two?
I know. I'm convinced you're a racist, but don't tell me. Anyway,
it seems like I try really hard not to be. I mean, you don't even have to try hard. You know, it seems like it should be your default setting, yeah. right? I don't know why.
It's just in your DNA. It's just,
I guess so. Look, I'm from the South, so who knows? It's just always going to be there.
Exactly, exactly. So, long story short, the movie, you know, ends triumphantly, except that he dies when he gets run off the road, but it does lead to good
also,
things.
Also, Greg, I mean, like...
The last 10 minutes drags, doesn't it? Like, to wrap it all up, what is going on?
That was 30 minutes. Also, the scene, like... I audibly laughed out loud when he goes screeching off the road on his motorcycle and they pan up and like in the tree branches are his riding goggles hanging there. It is such a stupid, like cliche.
It couldn't show like, it's 1962. They couldn't show his brain splattered.
Filmmaker, like, teach you in film school, don't do this. Yeah. Like, it's so dumb. I tried to go, I mean, I went into it with an open mind because I've never even, like, honestly, of the 8 films that are on in our bracket, this is probably the one I'm least familiar with. I know nothing of this movie. I didn't know it was set in World War I. I didn't know it was based on a real story. I honestly thought I was going to watch some, like, movie set in the 1800s. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I went into this probably with as open a mind as I have ever gone into a movie. And within 5 minutes, I had started to feel the cracks in the foundation of my being level-headed about this experience. It only got worse from the dangling motorcycle goggles in the tree scene.
So I don't hate it as much as you do. There's parts of it I really like. I had a clip that I was going to show, but I'm not going to now because we're running short on time. But it has moments. But that being said, I can think of, right off the top of my head, over 100 movies that I like better or more.
Yeah.
I rewatched probably one of my all-time favorite movies this week, Dog Day Afternoon, with Al Pacino and John Cassell, who, again, in the next movie we're about to cover. And what reason I watched it again was because I rewatched Godfather for probably the 100th time, and it's got Vincent Cassell and Al Pacino in it. And Dog Day Afternoon, if you've never seen it, you should see it. To me, it should be in, I'm sure it's in this list somewhere, but it is an amazing film. And that being said, let's transition into our number 2 seed for this box office battle, and it is The Godfather. Now, I think after what we just discussed, I think we got a clear winner here. I don't know if we're going to need to vote, but that being said, it really even if Lawrence of Arabia had been half as good as it could have been, I don't know how you beat Godfather.
Even the slow parts of The Godfather, of which there are a few, are better than almost anything that we watched in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
The movie starts, The Godfather, with kind of a long, seemingly uneventful wedding party. We do establish this foundation of a Sicilian on his daughter's wedding day can't say no. We're establishing the influence that Don Corleone has. We're establishing family dynamics, but it's not, you know, wham bam packed full of, you know, craziness. But even this, and it's probably a close fight between this and the scenes in Sicily for kind of slowing us down a bit, but even those are so much better than what we saw in any capacity in Lawrence of Arabia, honestly, than anything we have seen in any movies so far.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead with you're our outline guy, but I just can't.
Well, no, I agree with you. The thing is I've watched Godfather, I don't know how many times I've watched it, but I do know this, is that when when I was a young man and before I had met my wife, I started hanging around with a group of people. They had a house that everybody hung out at, and I was in the military, so I lived on base in the dorm, so it was nice to be away from the base and hanging out with real people. And they had a VCR, but they didn't have a lot of movies. So I was talking to a young girl there in the house, and I was like, you know, have you seen this? Have you seen this? Have you ever seen The Godfather? No. You've never seen The Godfather. And I'm like 20, you know, maybe 21. And the next weekend, I brought the two VHS tape set.
Yeah.
And we sat down and watched it. And now, 30-odd years later, I'm married to that woman. And so it's a very important film to me. But on top of that, I've watched it multiple times over and over. My wife and I just watched it about maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And yet I watched it again this week. And it never gets old. It just doesn't. It's something about this film that for me, and I can't speak for everyone, that every moment of this film doesn't feel wasted. It feels like it builds to an amazing climax. It is layered with character development. It has some of the best characters you'll ever see in film. And the story behind the making of it is fascinating as well, with the fact that they wanted it to be as authentic as it could be. Mario Puzo, who wrote the novel, wrote it to be an homage, if you will, to the mafia, but he just wanted it to be realistic. He didn't want to glorify it, and that was the problem that some people had when it came out, was it was going to glorify the mafia, and then the actual mafia thought it was going to make them look bad, and they were afraid of the film, and they actually tried to shut the film down until the producer, Al Ruddy, went to the mafia guys and the Columbo, who was the big guy at the time, and invited his guys to be extras. One of the guys who plays, I think it's Carmine, was a real mafioso member. So he hired real guys from it. They were able to oversee it. He kind of invited them in, became this really weird partnership or friendship with Columbo to get the film finished. And then they stopped having problems with the mafia once they did this. So it's got this authenticity about it. It doesn't go over the top. We've seen a million mafia movies since.
Scarface, you know, I know it's different.
Yeah, it's Cuban
mafia, but
I like Goodfellas. I won't put in there, but there's others. I mean, anything outside of Scorsese and Coppola, they're good mafia films out there, but some of them are just, they can be cheesy. This is so authentic. It is, and they worked really hard to make it that way.
And this is a long film too.
Yeah,
and in contrast to Lawrence of Arabia, just like you said, nothing is wasted in this. Everything builds upon something you saw before. It layers upon itself like a tiramisu, you know.
Yeah,
that it ends up being perfect.
The
characters you mentioned are great, but the casting of those characters is also great.
Oh yeah.
And I have an interest in the mafia from just it's such a foreign concept, being from, you know, the South, and it seems like such a uniquely, I know it was nationwide, but it seems like a uniquely Northeast type thing. And so I watch a lot of documentaries. There's a really great one. It's not in depth, but it does a good job of talking about like the 70s and 80s, right before the kind of fall of the mafia, called Fear City, at a time when the mafia kind of had control of a lot of New York City. That's a really good one. So I have an interest in this, and this is probably goes back a little further, because this is like just post, this is set
right
just post World War II, because we have our World War II hero, Michael, who has come back. I have watched this film, Greg, before. I watched it for Mafia Movie May for the, Jared Goes to the Movies podcast,
right,
which, as you will recall, the men on that show, me and Jared and Sean, had a much different experience with Mafia Movie May than the girls, Amy and Casey, did. They hated it. We loved it. I honestly, and I remember at the time loving it. It took me until this watch, and so this is only the second time I've seen it. I guess I didn't realize the first time how much this story is called The Godfather, but it's about Michael.
Yes.
And his kind of, at first, his attempts to kind of stay out of the family business. Yes. He has a girlfriend.
Yes.
He's just come back from war. All the characters around him make it a point to kind of insulate him from the things that are happening. Everyone knows that.
Yeah.
They can send him places that the others otherwise couldn't go because everyone knows he's not a part of it.
Yeah.
And obviously, over the course of the film, that sometimes gradually, sometimes very quickly, changes, you know, his trajectory. But I don't recall it. Maybe it's just maybe I'm making myself look stupid because it's very obvious that's what the movie's about. But I think watching it the first time, I was watching it because I needed to watch it to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And this time I was able to just watch it and enjoy it and know that you and I would just discuss it. So I don't know. It felt different, but I mean, that's this movie. This is the story of Michael and the journey that he takes based on all of these events happening around him. But it's like, it's not a revenge story per se.
No, it's,
but there's an aspect of revenge to it, but it's so brilliantly layered.
What do they say throughout the film? It's business. It's never personal. That's the whole thing is that, yes, he changes once the moment comes when his father is attempted assassination occurs and he sees the newspaper. You start to see a change and then it just keeps building when he goes to the hospital. And we'll get to that in a minute. But it's so interesting that you bring that up about Michael, and the film really is about Michael, and then it carries over into The Godfather 2, probably again one of the best films ever made, and not in the top eight, which I don't understand, but we'll discuss that in depth maybe when we get to the final four, because honestly, you pair one and two together and they'll kick the ass of just about any film ever made. But
I've never seen the second one.
Oh my goodness,
I thought the second one had the reputation.
My screen is not frozen,
like
my screen did not freeze. I'm literally just seen the second.
Is it number three that has the reputation of being like the worst sequel that's ever been made in movie history?
Okay, yeah. The three is not loved. I like three. I don't love three. Three has to be taken in a certain way because it was made in the 90s. So it is not got the same atmosphere.
It's like of its time.
And it doesn't have the same atmosphere. The things had changed. I like three. I don't love it. But damn, if you've not seen two is considered better than one. So two continues the Michael Corleone story, which is freaking amazing. And then they also interspersed with that. It cuts back and forth between Vito, played by Marlon Brando in the first one, when he was a young man, except in I can't believe you've never seen the second one. Well,
I thought the only reason I brought three into it was because I think I thought Godfather 2 was the one that had the reputation of we created the best movie that's ever been made and followed it up with this piece of shit. No. But you're telling me that it's just as good, if not better. So I will watch Godfather 2 on my own outside of, you know, the show because I enjoyed this so much.
It is.
OK, so anyway.
Yeah. So and Vito is played by Robert De Niro. So you get this backstory of Vito coming to New York and the evolution of the Corleone family as well. And it parallels Michael's ascension to freaking godhood in the mafia world. But that all being said, the clip that I chose for The Godfather is exactly what you were talking about. It takes place during the wedding scene. And it is basically Michael illustrating the fact that he has nothing to do with this. And he's telling Kay what's going on. So let's take a look at this real quick. This is one of the best scenes in the film.
Please, Michael, tell me.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract with a big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson. And my father went to see this band leader. And he offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, my father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
Well, how did he do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. It's a true story.
Ma ballarezza stunga morir.
That's my family, Kenny. It's not me.
Yeah, exactly.
I like how much Diane Keaton anticipated a happy ending to that story. And the look on her face when, oh,
yeah,
okay, all right, yeah.
But the fact that it's so masterfully done. I've watched this so many times into the point where now every time I see it, I pick up something new like that, where that's saying something in the film. Where Michael's clearly saying, I have nothing to... In fact, it's almost like he looks down on them. He's disgusted by them. He went off to be a war hero. He went off to war to get away from them. And it's so many significant things that come out of that. But we mentioned the wedding scene. And what's brilliant about that wedding scene is how Francis Ford Coppola, when he adapted the novel, they knew they had a lot to deal with in the Mario Puzo novel. And actually, him and Puzo wrote the screenplay together. And they had to come up with a way to identify all the characters in a quick way to kind of build on that and do all that exposition. And so that wedding scene, like you said, goes 20 minutes, and it introduces everybody. The thing was that that he felt that it was, the wedding sequence was a little hollow. And then he came up with the Bonacera sequence to open the film, where the mortician comes and asks for a favor. And he, you know, wants the men who raped his daughter killed. And then they just decide, okay, that's not fair. It's a brilliant scene.
Yep. It's just, and I, there is no reason besides the fact that they happened to get matched up for this episode of our show for us to ever compare Lawrence of Arabia to The Godfather. But on many levels now, especially after having seen them both, it's not fair. But I mean, it is fair. These are all professionals. And it's not like Mario Puzo's novel any better of a subject matter than the life and times of E. Lawrence,
right?
You know, just one was executed really well. This movie's long, but never feels long. And Lawrence of Arabia was executed, in my opinion, really poorly, and right, is long and probably feels longer than it is.
Right.
So it's so great. And yes, they introduce the Robert Duvall as the consigliere.
Yes.
But he's James Caan. Who,
and so boy, that's the thing, is that there was a lot of things with the casting where the studio, there's so much, and I will get into the making of toward the end of this review, but they wanted the names. So that's why James Caan is there, even though he's not Italian, but he plays Sonny extremely well. Al Pacino, Coppola had to fight for because he was short and the studio didn't want him. Coppola had seen him in a stage play and was like, that is Michael. And God bless him for fighting for him. Talia Shire, who is Coppola's niece, I believe they're related, and was almost didn't want to audition because she didn't want to think that she got the part because of nepotism, but she's amazing as Connie.
And,
yeah. And mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's so many things to like about the cast. I mean, really, to be honest, we could go on all night about the film. Kriplius actually brought up a really good point about that scene where they talking about Sinatra. So there's some really interesting stuff about that scene. Of course, this is the scene where Johnny Fontaine, who is the singer in the movie, wants a part in the film, and so they send Tom Hagen to Hollywood to lobby for Stoltz, the producer, to get the part. He won't give it to Johnny because he violated the girl that Stoltz wanted. And so they take his prized thoroughbred and they leave him a present. I mean, it's one of the most iconic scenes in the film, and it's the whole offer he couldn't refuse again. And so Johnny Fontaine gets a part. Now, Frank Sinatra, the part was not necessarily based on Frank Sinatra. And I know this from other sources and documentaries that I've seen, but it was a loose amalgam of all of the Italian singers.
Bobby Darin.
Exactly. Bobby
Enrico Caruso. Yeah, and
that worked with the mafia. So Puzo really wrote it about all of the ones that had dealings with the mafia. He didn't sing, but it just happened that when the movie was being done, it was played more like it was Sinatra. And it was a funny thing that happened was Puzo was out to dinner and Sinatra saw him and threatened to beat his ass in the restaurant. And Puzo said, man, if I hadn't been older than he was, I think he would have done it. The truth was Puzo was like 4 years younger than Sinatra at the time, but Puzo was terrified. And he was like, I didn't get it. He's threatening a Northerner with violence. I'm a Northern Italian. I'm peaceful. The Southerners are the mafia. So it's like, dude, but yeah. So yeah, it wasn't technically based on Sinatra, but it was based on that whole character. There's so many things in the storyline of the film. If you've seen the film, and I think that people are watching this most or listening to it on our podcast, for all the way, I want to say real quick, we had a massive amount of people listen to us on Spotify last week. Thank you so much. I see the numbers. I appreciate it. Keep listening. Tell your friends about us. And we really appreciate it because we want to be able to grow this, not just for Eric and I, but just to be able to have a place where we can talk about movies. So thank you for the streams.
And my ego would appreciate it. You know, it's already so fragile and I just need something to feel like, you know, is successful
exactly
in my life. So yeah, keep listening. Now I have been putting Spotify on my phone and just turning the volume down at night and having it repeat the show over and over again.
So that's where that's coming from.
So I don't know if that helped, but. Probably that's didn't good. Hurt anything, right?
Yeah. Well, so just to say that, though, I did want to point that out because
that's awesome.
I didn't even mention at the beginning. You see on the screen our contact info. If you want to send us an email, it's boxofficebattles@gmail.com. YouTube is at boxofficebattlepodcast. And Twitch is boxofficebattlepod. We're on all the major podcast providers. We're on YouTube and Twitch. And then when we hit our 60 days on Facebook, we'll all be on Facebook Live. So just tell your friends, if you love the show, this is what we want to do each and every week. And we have a lot of fun doing it. So back to Godfather. Just want to say that there's a lot we could talk about for both our live audience. But if you're watching this and listening to it on the podcast and you love Godfather, you know everything is. We don't need to break the plot down for you. There is significant events that happen in the plot. Of course, the assassination of Don Corleone, where the driver doesn't report for work because he's sick. And one of my favorite lines of the movie, which was ad-libbed, when they take him for a little ride and they shoot him in the back of the head and they say, leave the gun, take the cannoli.
Yeah.
That was ad-libbed.
I was trying to think about what line you were talking about.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I think I recall reading, so you mentioned, and kind of besides the opening scene, one of the very big formative scenes of the movie is the attempted assassination. You know, he walks across the street and was getting fruit from a fruit stand. Yeah. And I recall reading that in this movie, every time that oranges are visible in a scene, they kind of the word is escaping me, but it's supposed to represent death like in some way. Coming. Is that ringing a bell to you at all? Does that sound like, or maybe I'm making it, maybe it was a different movie where oranges represented death.
I'll buy it. I mean, I'm not going to dispute it. I've never heard that, but there it is. That's what he's going to get is to buy oranges. And then what I love about this scene is freaking Fredo. And he's the whole thing where he just tries to get his gun out of his pocket and he drops it. John Cassell is brilliant. You know, the thing about John Cassell, I got to say this real quick, who plays Fredo, he was only in, I want to say, three movies in his career before he passed away, and all of them won Best Picture.
Huh.
Which is
He plays the world's biggest fucking pussy really well in yes. this movie. No backbone, and it's not just for this scene, because yep. if you're not used to it, and I don't, you know, and getting used to it is a thing in itself, but reacting quickly and confidently to the assassination attempt of your father, you know, would be tough
yeah.
for anyone. So it's not just that he doesn't know how to handle himself in this acute situation, but we find out later on that he is just a spineless turd, but he plays it so well.
Oh, I love when Vito is laying there and Papa, he's just yelling at him. Dude, you're dead.
And he just sits there. He just sits down.
But yeah, so here's the thing. John Cassell was in four films before he died of cancer. He was in The Godfather, won Best Picture. He was in The Godfather 2, won Best Picture. He was in The Conversation with Gene Hackman, won Best Picture. And he was in Dog Day Afternoon. And he actually won Best Supporting Actor for that as well. He's an amazing actor for what he does, but for that, four films, and then he unfortunately died untimely of cancer to do what he did. He's one of my favorites, and yeah, Fredo. And if you like him in Godfather, you're sure they're going to love Godfather 2. But yeah, so they deal with Carlo. Yeah, go ahead.
Obviously, you know, for anyone listening to the show who wasn't aware, you know, please just sit down and just have a moment. John Cassell dead at the age of 51. So rest in peace, John. All right, back to you, Greg.
You're very close. He was 50. Yeah,
I don't know. 53. I just pulled that out of my ass.
He was 53. Very close. I was just doing the ad right now. All right. That's very good. Mike actually said that oranges are a visual cue to death or violence. So there you go. You heard it somewhere.
LeBlanovitz knows what's up. Maybe Mike told me that.
Maybe
that's why I think
It was. Another great scene is, this is again the evolution of Michael when he goes to the hospital to visit his father, and there's nobody there. Everybody's been pulled out, and that's when we get introduced to the dirty cop, as well as the florist that owed him a favor and shows up. My favorite part is when he's trying to light a cigarette outside of the hospital. Everybody's shaking, but yeah. So brilliant. And again, it leads to the evolution of Michael. It leads to more of him. Like, you see him becoming a man at that point, and you know that he's so pissed at that point when the cop punches him and he offers to be the one to take out Sollozzo and the cop.
Yeah. This scene, again, everything is so perfectly crafted mm-hmm. and nothing is wasted. And this one is, as far as I recall from the film, gives you that sense of anxiety more than any of the other scenes, because
but it doesn't have any long desert scenes.
Yeah, that's a real bummer. Yeah. I mean, listen. I was just going to say, like, this one with the empty halls and kind of, you know, they're coming, but you don't see them. And so this whole thing was,
that's great,
again, very well crafted to make you feel a certain way for this. And this is a long kind of scene as well. We do get some, like, if I'm being honest, I could have probably done without seeing anything that happened in Sicily. I know that after what you just talked about, after this hospital scene, he volunteers to go be the one to carry out the business, and he has to leave to let the heat die down.
So for those who don't know that Michael, the whole scene with the gun taped to the back of the toilet, and he kills McCluskey, the bad cop, and Sollozzo, and then he has to flee. To till the heat dies down. One of the best parts of that before he leaves is the part where they tell Vito that Mike was the one that did it. Oh my gosh. When he turns away, because he knew that was it. Mike was in.
He was corrupted now.
He wanted one son that wasn't a part of that. It's a brilliant scene by Marlon Brando. I actually love it. A quick note of that, when they lift Marlon Brando's character, Vito, from the stairs up to his room on the bed, Marlon Brando played a prank on the cast by putting weights underneath his bed so it would make it. So apparently he pulled a lot of pranks on set, and that was one of many. So yeah, but that scene where he finds out that Michael did it, but I get the Sicily hate, but I love the Sicily stuff, and I'll tell you why. Well, first of all, when they made the film, they actually went to Sicily to do it, and the studio did not want them to do the Sicily stuff. It's in the book. The thing of what it does for me is it signifies Michael's transformation all the way to the end. It shows that he never really loved Kay, that Kay was kind of a figurehead for the life that he wanted to lead. She was a representation of that true blue American life. And then he gets to Italy and he meets a Italian girl. And I believe
Apollonia
was his true love. The whole scene where he's talking about her and his friends describing her body, and the father runs away and he goes, oh shit, that's his daughter. It's a brilliant scene. And when he says that, your daughter would be losing a father if people knew I lived here instead of gaining a husband. It's like, that's a cool ass scene. And I think it's so significant because, and I'll get to that in a minute. It's just that the fact that they get married and he marries Apollonia, and it's brilliant, and they're having this life together. And one of my favorite things to do with my wife was when she says, when are we going to this? What day are we going there? I always go, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
I know the English.
So I always do that. She's adorable. And then unfortunately she's blown up when one of his own men wire the car. Now, side point to that. In the movie, the guy just disappears and gets away. When you watch Godfather Part 2, there you don't see anything about Apollonia. But there is a deleted scene that I do have. Oh. When they put the Godfather Part 2 on TV, I don't have it on here right now. I should have added it to it. Maybe in the final four, I'll add the scene so you can see it.
Okay, yeah, I want some more context.
The guy is awarded by Bassini for attempting to kill Michael and killing his wife. And he ends up getting a pizza joint in New York. And Michael finds out about it and blows the fucker up in his own car. It's a brilliant scene. But it never was in Godfather Part 2. They cut it because it was like at that point they went, do we really need to show him getting revenge? Yes, we do. The dude helped kill his wife. I needed to see that.
I would have liked to seen that. Now, you explaining... Because obviously I know for a film like this, I must be missing something if I ever consider a scene to be quote unquote wasted, because right. No other part of it is.
Yeah.
You know, so I must give the benefit of the doubt to scenes that maybe I don't quite understand. So a lot of the Sicily stuff's kind of seemed like, okay, I get it. But your description of the dichotomy between Kay as a representative example, not of the true love of his life, but as, you know, the war hero settles down with the hometown girl, you know, great American tale versus what becomes his reality over time is really poignant. So that's very smartly done.
Like I said, well, I've watched it a couple hundred times. And so when I see the scenes in Sicily, it reminds me, it shows me what Michael could have been. Had Michael brought Apollonia to the States, she would have been more like Vito's wife. She would have been that obedient Italian wife that would have been in his side, ready to go to the mattresses with Michael. Kay, what we get is this white bread representation of Americana, and why it's so brilliant at the end. When he's telling her, don't ask about my business, Kay. Don't ask about my business. Then he slams this and he lies straight to her. Michael never would have lied to Apollonia. And that's the kind of the symbolism of it that I really enjoy. So I think the Sicily part is really significant. It's not very long. And then you get boobies too. So there's, you know, there's some good parts about it.
There were boobs. Kelsey looked up and was like, oh. It's like, yeah, but it's okay.
It's brief.
It's fine.
brief.
Yeah.
Cripplia says the cat should have won an Oscar. You know, there is a funny story about the cat. I've watched a lot of making of this movie. The cat was a stray that wandered in to the set, and Brando thought, oh, well, I'll just hold the cat. And it was, they were like, you know what? That works really freaking well. Hold the cat.
Yeah.
Problem was that the cat was so contented with Brando's petting and stroking that he purred so loudly that his dialogue was messed up, and they had to redub his scenes when he's holding the cat. Just a little,
that is funny.
A little trivia there. A little trivia. But yeah, so the scenes with in Sicily are amazing. Let's run down the rest of it. We know what happens with freaking Connie and her husband. And I think the scene where Sonny beats the hell out of him, a lot of it was improvised. He actually hurt her husband, who was actually a real mafioso guy, former mafioso guy. The trash can scene where he beats him with the trash can lid, improvised. And then, of course, that led to one of the best freaking deaths.
Sonny, man, look what they did.
Look what they did to my boy.
But he doesn't say it that way, does he? He says, look how they massacred my boy.
Look
right?
how they massacred. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I always say, you know, look what they did to my boy.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the right. That's right. But yeah, I mean, is this the most gunshots per death in cinema history? Because it like became comically long.
Oh, yeah.
After a while. I was like, okay, we get it.
It was clearly an overkill. It was like there was more to the killing than just that was just hatred. It was the
death part.
Yeah, they were making a point that they were gonna kill him. There's a lot of great scenes in the film. I mean,
lots of good Luca Brasi death. Yeah, it happens early.
Oh yeah,
earlier in this, but film, that is such a good scene where he walks in and they stick the knife in his hand and then come, you know, grab him from behind. I remember being like, oh shit. And that's where we get the Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes tonight. There's so much of this movie that has made its way into our popular culture. And this movie is 50 years old and things people still say, look what they did to my boy, sleeps with the fishes. Like these are common, you know, things to hear.
Yeah. We could literally go on for another half an hour, but there's no need. There's some great stuff. The death of Corleone, where he's putting the friggin' oranges into his mouth with his grandson is hilarious. I mean, Saturday Night Live lampooned it with John Belushi, which was awesome. If you've never seen that, it was a significant role, you know, the way he passes away. There's so much. The ending of the scene when Michael is named a godfather to Connie and Carlo's kid, and they basically settle all family business.
Man, that
they take
so
out. Yeah.
Kelsey looks up and is like, it got really loud all of a sudden. And I'm like, hell yeah, it did. I mean, the shit hits the fan, and you want to talk about a textbook climax of a movie.
Yeah.
You know, because some movies do it really well and some movies don't, and some movies don't have to have that moment per se. And some movies really rely on it. And this movie would have been good without it. But the first of all, the kind of, again, the dichotomy between the chaos of the killings and the keep cutting back to the scene, the baptism within the church.
Oh yeah.
Like that is very, very powerful and stunning. But that scene of all of the different murders and the way that they prepared for them and carried them out and got it, like we have seen that type of shot so many times since then.
Right.
You know, because it's so expertly done. There are so many movies that make use of that same type of pacing and blocking and editing and the music all coming together, but they can't do it the way this was done. It was so good, Greg.
Yeah, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's like he says, and what's great about it leading up to that, it seems like Michael's on the ropes. Like he goes mm-hmm. to try to get the casino from Mo Green, and he's kind of yelled down by Mo Green. That Tessio is now working with Bassini, and that's his longtime, is one of his father's most trusted men. And I love Abe Bagoda as Tessio. And so it's like there's nowhere for Michael to run. He's being pushed out. And he says it, you know, to Fredo, we're going to settle all the family business. And he does. He settles it all in one moment. And he's at the christening to complete an utter, you know, alibi or just distance himself from the situation. And it's brilliant. Yep. So with one fell swoop, and he takes out everyone and now is kind of basically what's left behind. And then, of course, they kill Carlo when, you know, Connie, and then, of course, Connie comes in and yells at him for killing her husband. The dude that was beating the hell out of her, beating her senseless, and then ended up resulting in her brother being killed and Sonny, and she's still mad at Michael for taking the son of a bitch out. Godfather Part 2, she's a totally different creature. She's a trip. So you'll enjoy that. There's more to Connie in the second one. But yeah, then we finish out with, you know, that whole scene I talked about where Michael's final transformation into the Don is complete, and Kay is left to wonder, oh, what the hell did I just marry into? And that's kind of where it goes. It's an amazing ending to an amazing picture that is, to me, I've heard people like of this generation, Gen Z, maybe a few millennials, refer to The Godfather as boring. And
what?
I get that in this day and age where a 3-hour movie, when you're used to TikTok videos and Vines, is probably could be. But all I say is just watch it again. I mean, watch it again and just take your time and take your Ritalin and kind of chill and enjoy what this has to offer, because it is an exceptionally well-crafted film. Now, one of the things before we get to the vote, which I think is going to be obvious where that goes, is I'd mentioned the making of this movie and all that took a place into getting this film done. Albert S. Ruddy, who was an amazing producer, this was his first film he ever produced. He believed in the Puzo novel. He wanted to take it on, and he wrote a book about his experiences getting the film done. It is fascinating. And if you haven't seen it, I'm doing a shameless plug. We don't get paid for this advertising. There is a show on Paramount Plus called The Offer, and it is outstanding. If you haven't seen it, it is like 10 episodes, if I'm not mistaken, and it goes into everything that they went through with building this film from the ground up, how he ended up being able to get it made. Miles Teller plays Albert Ruddy, which is amazing. They have
like a docudrama. So it's not a documentary. It's actors.
It's a dramatization of how they made the greatest movie almost never made is the tagline. Wife and I watched it and almost liked it as much as I did the movie. If you've not seen it, I can't recommend it enough, because now I will say this, it does embellish some of the things. It's not like everything else. It's not completely accurate. I looked some of the things up, but a lot of it did get right. And if you love the film, there's some really cool scenes that they reenact. The guy that they have that plays Brando, I'm trying to look him up if he's even in the credits. Just an amazing actor. The guy that plays Al Pacino is incredibly like Al Pacino. Dan Fogler plays Francis Ford Coppola. Colin Hanks is in it as one of the producers for Paramount, and as well as Giovanni Ribisi plays Joe Colombo. You see him in the background to the left of Miles Teller. Mm-hmm. He plays Joe Colombo, who was the mafia guy that was trying to get the movie shut down. So anyway, just to film to wrap it up, The Offer is an amazing miniseries, about 10 episodes, and it's worth it. So you will enjoy it. So if you want to know more about the filming of The Godfather.
Good recommendation, Greg.
Yeah. So,
well, do you want to vote?
Some last comments. Mike Florida said, my grandparents loved it. My parents as well. I'm 45 and enjoy it too. It's one of the first films my family had on VHS. Yep. I had the two taper.
It's funny because I remember, I think Titanic was the first film that I saw that came
in a two VHS set like that, I remember just thinking, what in the world?
We had a few of those. My mom had like Gone with the Wind and the two set and Ben Hur and the Ten Commandments. She had all those. So, yeah.
I honestly think I probably was thinking I was going to watch Ben Hur when Lawrence of Arabia came in. Like the name of it just invoked to me like fucking Cleopatra and like chariot races. But now that you say that, like that's definitely Ben Hur I was thinking of.
I will say this. I probably would have enjoyed Ben Hur and Ten Commandments more than I did Lawrence of Arabia. So
honestly, and I don't know how much crossover we'll have from people who know me from Jarrett Goes to the Movies or you for that matter. I hated more than any movie that I've ever seen in my entire life. two movies that I watched for that show. One was The Love Guru.
Okay. Yeah.
And the other was Beetlejuice.
Oh, wow.
And I think those are two of the most unfunny fucking pieces of shit that I have ever had the misfortune of being obligated to sit through in my entire life. I will put Lawrence of Arabia up there. And really, I would watch The Love Guru and or Beetlejuice again, because at the very least, I'm only sitting through an hour and a half of the stupidest shit that ever was imagined and created and then unfortunately put on film, as opposed to watching 3.5 hours of some of the worst storytelling in movie history. Okay, Mike, but still, fuck all of Beetlejuice. If you watched it for the first time like I did as a grown-ass adult 30 years after it came out, you would agree with me. It's not fucking funny. It's so not funny that it almost becomes funny in that way, except it doesn't. Because it takes itself too seriously. It is
so crazy. I don't know anybody that hates Beetlejuice. I really don't. You're the first person. And I remember when you were on Jarrett Goes to the Movies and you didn't like it. And it's so weird that you're so passionate about that movie, because everybody I know absolutely loves it. So
that's why I'm that passionate about it, because people want to act like I'm the crazy one. I'm not crazy. You guys are crazy. I'm not crazy. You're crazy.
I think it's probably Tim Burton's best film, other than maybe the first Batman.
Jesus fucking Christ. You guys are
insufferable. I love the banana boat song scene.
This is a bit.
No, it's just it's the truth.
You can't convince me otherwise. I'm part of like a Truman Show-esque social experiment where they show this movie to everyone on Earth and everyone acts like they like it, and I'm the only one with the courage to stand up and say this movie's a pile of crap. And then
it just doesn't hit for you.
It shouldn't hit for anybody. And I'm not one to tell other people their business. I am a live and let live in almost every aspect of my life. If you're not hurting somebody else, I want you to do that thing. Your kinks, your whatever, like you do your fucking thing. But if your kink is subjecting somebody else to watching Beetlejuice, then that's abuse. That does affect other people, and that's not okay. And I will call the fucking police, because that's some craziness. But anyway, I vote for The Godfather. Not the unfunny piece of shit Beetlejuice, and not the unfunny piece of shit.
I'm gonna pass out.
Lawrence of Arabia may have funnier parts of it than Beetlejuice does, just because O'Toole is such a like understated like funny guy in that movie.
I won't debate you on Beetlejuice. Let's just say we've had some of the fans of Jarrett Goes to the Movies and people that are starting to watch our show. Again, this is just episode 3. We're just getting started. And they want your honest review of Beetlejuice 2 when it comes out. So we've been asked for you to go see it.
I'm not going to do that. I will do it for the sake of the show. I know people want to see me get wound up. And I'll do my best to go into it
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how that's possible.
I've seen the trailer for it. I don't trust anything remakes or sequels these days because none of them seem to be that good. That being said, I did see the new Deadpool Wolverine. Fantastic. We really enjoyed it. My wife said she's never laughed that hard. And my wife doesn't go in for over-the-top violence or language. And she just loved the film because it was just that damn funny. And so many cameos make for a great film because it's basically making fun of itself. I don't know what Beetlejuice is going to be like. The new one, we'll probably go see it. I saw it in the theater with a date, one of my ex-girlfriends from years and years and years ago. And we loved it. It was a good time. It was a good time.
Big fucking deal. I don't care about that.
So anyway, you vote for Godfather. Well, yes. I guess I'm gonna have to vote for Lord. No, hell no, I'm not voting for Lawrence of Arabia.
There's no way.
No, there's no way. We knew this was coming. So we know the winner of this battle. Definitely the Godfather. And I may even watch it again next week. I don't know. I've watched it so many times. You need to watch part two. I think you'll really enjoy Godfather
Part Board.
2. Yeah, you'll have a blast with that. So anyway, want to thank everyone again for joining Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We're really appreciative to everybody who's tuned in so far. If you're listening to us on Spotify or Amazon Music or any of the other podcast providers, please make sure you subscribe so you get each and every episode. And also, please tell people about the show. Because if you really enjoy it, just want to share it so that you have something to talk about. And again, we want to hear your comments. If you want to email us with questions or comments about the show or any future topics. Now, we have some topics coming up. I do want to mention for a preview, we've got topics coming up after the AFI Top 8. Eric and I have already talked about it. We're going to do the Top 8 sports comedies of all time. That's going to be insane. We're going to have a good time. But there's other topics that we have thought of, things that I've thought of. I thought of one the other day that I wrote down, and it's top 8 movies about bands that were never really bands, that were fictional.
Okay.
So like The Commitments and The Five Heartbeats and CB4.
The O'Neaters.
What is that?
The O'Neaters from That Thing You Do.
That Thing You Do. Yeah, that's another one. What was another one? Spinal Tap.
Oh.
So, yeah. So there's some great categories out there. If you have an idea for a category for us, we'd love to hear it. Email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. Also, each and every week, you can follow us on YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. Please do so. Tell your friends to follow us. Our next podcast, we're going to be away for just a little while, about 10 days, and we are going to handle the fourth seed, which is Robert De Niro and Raging Bull. Against the fifth seed, Singing in the Rain.
What a matchup. How can we decide? I just mean two very, very, very seemingly different movies. So to decide which of these is the better movie, I think will be really fun. The ones we've done so far have been similar enough to move one over the other based on criteria kind of that you apply to both.
Right.
So it'll be very interesting to me to see how we navigate something like this. Should be fun.
Yeah, I think these couldn't be two more polar opposite of films. A black and white boxing film by Martin Scorsese versus an upbeat musical. Now, I will say this. I like both films. Before we get into it, I'm not going to go too deep into it, but Singing in the Rain is a brilliant film. It's one of my favorite films ever. So we'll have to see if Raging Bull wins me over. But I love Scorsese. So can't say what will happen. Yep. So tune in on August 11th. That all being said, we want to thank everybody again for joining us and please tell everybody about us. And I will turn it over to Eric if he's got anything else to say.
I got nothing. You guys take it easy. And until the next time we talk, be excellent to each other. We'll see y'all then.
I'll try to be excellent to you, Eric, because you know what?
You are excellent to me. I do appreciate it. You know that.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night. We'll see you on the 11th of August for Raging Bull versus Singing in the Rain. Until then, this has been Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Good night, everyone.